You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carborough. Freedom of expression is essential to a free society. And you were just listening to George Winston's Pixie as the beginning of Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Your host, Claudio, Renaissance man and bard of WCOM, has opened the doors of the Speakeasy to invite you all in to find a seat and get comfortable this morning, because here is the place where you're always welcome and can always expect the very best. Good morning, Claudio. What's up with you?
Good morning, oh, co-host and homesteader.
I'm doing well. Ah, yes, homesteader.
Yes, I'm gonna ask you some questions about how that is all coming together. I want to mention, first of all, though, that we are going to have a fascinating soul on board today. Actually, we already have him here. He's the senior director of the Carolina Theater. Good morning, Jim Carl.
Good morning, Claudio. Good morning, Audrey.
And we're going to be talking movies and all kinds of stuff, but I just wanted to give him a quick mention. Also want to acknowledge the historic Carolina Theater, primary sponsor of Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. You can find out what's going on there by going to carolinatheater.org. Check out all the new events coming up. It's always worth it. Next week, quick mention, I'm going to have Ken Fuller on. He has his own show here on WCOM, Fridays from 11 to 1 o'clock, Rock, Soul, and Pop. Again, Ken Fuller, quite a legend himself in the old music scene. Now, Audrey, over to you. You've still got your blog up about building your home or homesteading as you are.
Yes.
Give us a little scoop on that before we go any further.
Well, it's getting kind of exciting because I'm actually going to get plans drawn up for the house.
Ooh-hoo.
I mean, I've gone through all the whole thing about septic and driveway and, you know, all the prep stuff that you have to do before you can even start thinking about
it. And tell us again where this is. It's in the woods.
It's down in Chatham County, south of Pittsburgh, in the
woods.
And it's gorgeous. The leaves are changing and you can go to smallhousejournal.wordpress.com and see some pictures.
That's your blog, all right.
Yeah. And it's,
and you're not letting them cut the trees down, right?
Well, we had to cut a few trees down because I want to fit
in
there.
Oh, a few,
too.
Yes. But
if I had my ways, I would leave, you know, had my way, I'd live in a treehouse.
So would I.
A glass treehouse.
I don't know about the glass, no.
Oh, yeah. If it was possible, and in the best of all possible worlds, that's where I would live.
I might throw something at the window at some point and the whole darn glass house would come down. I don't know.
Well, this would be, it's a magical world, so It would not be breakable.
I see. All right. We're talking plexiglass here.
Well, we're talking, you know, if you want to dream it the way you want it.
Absolutely. I thought it'd be interesting to have a glass floor that you can see through, huh? Wouldn't that be a trip?
Yeah. Like a glass bottom boat or something.
Just don't trip over the edges. If you can find the edges.
We put some railings up.
Well, given our current state of political affairs, I hope this new Republican Party doesn't think for a minute that we think they deserve anything, because they have not moved far from the numbskulls they were in the past. And I'm certainly hoping that having two separate parties communicating will actually not result in gridlock. I came across this article recently that I think might be a shove in the right direction. It's called The Fix. It was recently in the St. Petersburg, Florida Times. The business section asked readers for ideas on how one would fix the economy. And I think this guy nailed it. Dear Mr. President, please find below my suggestion for fixing America's economy. Instead of giving billions of dollars to companies that will squander the money on lavish parties and unearned bonuses, use the following plan. You can call it the Patriotic Retirement Plan. There are about 40 million people over 50 in the workforce. Pay them $1 million apiece, severance, for early retirement with the following stipulations. They must retire. Thus, you have 40 million job openings. Unemployment is fixed. 2. They must buy a new American car, 40 million cars, ordered. Auto industry fixed. 3. They must either buy a house or pay off their mortgage. Housing crisis fixed. It can't get any easier than that. P.S. If more money is needed, have all members in Congress pay their taxes. Wouldn't that be something new? Mr. President, while you're at it, make Congress retire on Social Security and Medicare, and I'll bet you both programs would be fixed pronto. And I think that's the kick in the butt they need.
I wouldn't mind getting a check for $1 million.
I wouldn't either. I qualify, actually. I don't know. Does Jim qualify?
Well, not hardly. Hopefully not yet. Not for a few more years.
Not yet.
Please, Claudia. Please.
Ah, well, just gave myself away, didn't I? But anyway, I just wanted to sort of start the day with that. I'm hoping this new political situation improves and they don't think that George Bush won again. But we'll see what happens. I say at this point we should stay on our politicians, watch them, and make sure they govern us the way we want to be governed. Otherwise, kick them out mercilessly.
Well, you know, there's a thing with... Okay, I'm bringing up something and now a name is going out of my head.
Uh-oh.
Who was the
shows
black
that you qualify.
Mayor, our first black mayor here in Chapel Hill?
I know I'll recognize the name, but I'm...
Yes, so will I. He's got a Conversations with Howard Lee.
Oh, okay.
On PBS. And he makes a statement that leaders have to be prepared to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to be ready to go someplace that other people are afraid to go to. And try something other people say can't be done. Basically, that's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So as a leader, you have to be prepared to fail. Otherwise, you'll never try something new.
Well, let's see where that goes.
So, you know, I like that idea.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Well, I like the idea of fixing what needs to be fixed, too, instead
yes.
of their own pockets.
So,
which seems to be the only thing that gets fixed. They get rich and we go broke. Anyway, that's not the theme today. I just wanted to sort of get it off my chest. I'll try and behave now.
Howdy wants to throw everybody all out. And I'm always saying, you know...
Send him to Haiti.
Be a little bit moderate here. Anyway.
Yes, well, we'll see. I just don't like both sides. So it's not that I'm prejudiced against one party or the other. I don't like any of them.
Well,
and I don't think I'm alone.
Big organizations get out of control.
But now I will shut up on that theme and bring in the reason I'm glad to be here today. Senior Director of Carolina Theater, Jim Carl. I think we're going to talk about retro phantasma and movies in general.
Why don't we just talk about movies in general?
That sounds good.
Not classify ourselves to one particular genre. Why not?
We're not nailing that down, but I know that was a theme that you brought up.
Well, yeah. Retro Phantasma is a program that we have at the Carolina Theater. We've been doing it now for about 12 years. And it's genre films.
So it's birthday time. You got
it
a cake?
It is birthday time, yes. This coming Friday, we've got our 12th anniversary. And it is now becoming one of the longest running monthly genre film programs in the United States.
And he told me not to pick on a genre. Okay.
Yes.
That's
yes.
great, though. And that's
thanks to
you.
We don't call them horror movies. We call them genre movies.
Oh, I see.
It's back in the 80s when they didn't want to call them horror movies. They called them psychological thrillers.
I see. So that's not blood and guts. That's genre and psychological thriller
it's
spilling on
genre
you.
Genre films.
Well, there's
yes.
all kinds of different genres, aren't they?
There's all kinds of different
right.
genres. But in the industry, when you talk about a genre film, primarily you're talking about the horror, sci-fi, fantasy, the fantasy realm, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so then you have your thrillers, your police procedurals, your dramas, your comedies, and all the others. But when people talk about genre film in the industry, they are talking about basically the horror, sci-fi, fantasy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what do you call a film like the one I mentioned earlier before we got on the air by Benigni, Life is Beautiful? Now, what category does that belong to?
Well, you could classify that as a drama. You could classify
drama.
That as an
okay.
independent film,
drama,
a foreign
comedy.
Film.
Yeah.
I mean, those are all different subgenres.
Right. Right.
Those are all different subgenres. But what we've been focusing on when we opened the theater, when we reopened the theater after the renovation in 94,
right.
You know, the film program, I believe the idea was that we would be an independent art house cinema. So I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in New York. And I mean, I was military family, so I had lived in quite a few of the major cities. And to me, growing up in the 80s, art house theaters had this particular stigma, I would say, in my mind, at least those that started in the 80s, where you'd walk into an art house theater and it was basically the same five or six things you'd see on the wall. A picture of Marilyn Monroe over here, picture of James Dean, Humphrey Bogart, and a lot of retrospectives on things like Hitchcock, Truffaut, Godard.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the things that were happening back in the 80s when the art house movement first took off.
Right.
Long before there were things like, you know, the Weinstein Brothers and Miramax and Paramount Vantage, back when there were very, very few independent studios releasing real art house film. So when the theater opened up in 95 and I came on board, and it was, don't get me wrong, I didn't just walk in the door and suddenly become the head of film programming.
I remember those days.
I don't remember that at all.
Well, they just looked at you and said, this is what
this
you
is
can
guy.
Do.
Right?
This is the guy right here.
He looks like an art house. Bring him in.
Let's just pick this one. No, actually, I started the theater
working as a projectionist.
Aha.
And so when the theater first opened up, I walked in the door. I actually had moved down here from New York, and I was planning originally to attend UNC Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. But I needed my one-year residency, and they offered a degree in a program that I thought was really fascinating, which was audience research and analysis.
Hmm.
I wanted to work for Nielsen.
Uh-huh.
I love the entire concept of demographics and ratings and why do people enjoy one particular product versus another? What drives an audience to see one particular type of film versus another? And so the Nielsen ratings to me was something that very much appealed to me. And so audience research and analysis is what brought me to North Carolina in 1994. And then I waited for a year. And, of course, what happened in that year interim is that the Carolina Theater reopened its doors. I saw an ad in the paper, mm-hmm. and I thought, well, I might as well apply and see what's going on here. Never been to the Carolina Theater in my life. Had never even been to North Carolina that long. Had just moved down here.
What actually brought you here?
It was the idea of come down here for school.
I was just wondering why you were
school.
I was wondering why you were escaping the North.
Well, actually, after having lived in New York City for that many years, mm-hmm. I just really needed a break.
I can understand.
Really
that.
Needed
having
a break.
Having lived there myself, yeah.
Yeah. So the original plan had been to take a year, work at the Carolina Theater, make some money, get my in-state residency, and then go to get my graduate degree with audience research and analysis. Well, that's not what happened, of course. I ended up working at the Carolina Theater. They hired me on as a assistant working in the then video library.
Which was
they
a
had.
Great place.
It was phenomenal.
I
love
that place.
Yeah.
Great international selection of videos.
And also working as a projectionist. And 15 years later, you're still there, except I'm no longer working the projection room so much. I do oversee the projection department, but after 15 years of working at the Carolina Theater, I've become a huge advocate of the film programming at the mm-hmm. theater, of 35-millimeter film. But what's really been interesting for me for the last 15 years at the theater is having come on board so early in the reopening of the theater, when they had just reopened the cinemas, was being able to give the theater a branding, something that it didn't really have at the time. And when the city reopened the building, the idea, like I said, was it would be an art house film. Well, what is art house? Ask the average person on the street, they're going to say it's independent, foreign.
Mm-hmm.
When people think of art house, they think, well, Audrey, what do you think when I say the word art house?
Uh-oh,
what
Audrey.
Comes to your
Can't
mind?
I understand why they made that film.
But let me ask you this.
How long have you been saving that one up?
Let me ask you this. When you hear the word art house, doesn't it almost come to mind that you think of things like Hitchcock? You think of Godard. You think of Truffaut. You think of these artsy directors that are, again, for their own reasons, are very, very well known. But there is this stereotype out there in the community that an art house theater must show this type of product.
So you would almost say that it falls into style. To
exactly. It's a stereotype. Mm-hmm. It's a stereotype that an art house theater must have this type of programming because that's what it's there to exist for. And although I follow that degree of thinking to a certain point,
mm-hmm.
I do believe it's important to bring back Hitchcock's and Truffaut's and the Godards and Kurosawa's and Chaplin's and all those great films. I also look at it from the point of view that this is the kind of stuff that was being done back in the 80s. And if art house theaters are to survive, we also have to move forward with the times. And what else can we bring to the public other than what's art house theater has been doing for the last 25 years? So that's why when I came on board with the theater, it was important for us to find a branding, something that identified us as not just your average art house theater.
Well, let me interrupt for a second. Then.
Sure.
It would seem to me that the video store, I don't know if that was the before or during influence, but that kind of sort of reflects mm-hmm. what you're talking about. So was that sort of an experiment to see how it would work then, and then sort of use the influence?
Well, sort of. The video library that existed at the Carolina Theater preceded me. It was already there when I started working there. And the idea then, of course, was that it was a counter-programming against the blockbusters of the day, where you'd walk into a Blockbuster and all you saw were the Hollywood commercial titles, all of the Harry Potters and Bravehearts and all the big commercial films. The purpose of the video library was to offer the consumer a place where they suddenly could go to find good independent art house product mm-hmm. on the shelf and not have it sitting next to the Shrek and the other, the Disney films.
I didn't even have that.
But that was the purpose of the video library. When I started working with the film program, possibly in the late 90s at the theater, that was a long story into itself. One of the concepts that I had come up with and that I really wanted to do was to do something at the theater that was, again, set us apart from other art house theaters. And I'll turn myself in right now. I am a child of my own generation.
Let me get the cuffs.
As we all are. As we all are. We are children Absolutely. Of our own generations. The films that we grew up with as children, regardless of the quality of those films, hold a special place to each of us. They are dear to us for the associations that we have of when we saw them. They are dear to us for the people that we shared those memories with that went to see them with us in the theaters.
To a degree, but I would also have to interject and say that I've gone back and looked at some of the stuff that was really impressionable on me when I was that young, and I mm-hmm. go, what on earth did I ever see in that?
Exactly. So but there is ways. Still, there is still, it's all nostalgia.
Oh, absolutely.
It's that bittersweet nostalgia of being able to see things on the big screen that you grew up with and being able to experience them again with either your family or your friends and bringing in a new generation to find some of these things. And we're not necessarily talking about classic films here.
No.
That's the key word. And so... I am a very much of a product of my generation. I grew up in the 70s and 80s all over the country. And
he's
so,
not growing up anymore. So.
That's a different story, Claudio. But
we're always growing up. If we're lucky, we're always.
I'm growing older, but not up myself, thank you.
Yeah, but for me personally, the films of that time period, the 70s and 80s, the 60s even, are the ones that influenced my life, that influenced the way that I think today and make me the person that I am. So when I look back on my movie history as a mm-hmm. child, it's those particular films. Now, this is going to be different for everyone. It's going to be based on what part of the country you lived in, because, of course, some films would have only opened in certain parts of the country. Right. It's going to be based on your age and things like that. But, again, I think that when we started doing the film programming at the Carolina Theater, one of the things that I really wanted to do was give the theater an identity. And one of the things that I think we did very well was we got very, very early on board with this wave of nostalgia that has now swept the industry basically in the last 5 years. So what we decided to do back in the late 90s was create these film programs that would bring back to the screen some of the films that people of my generation watched when they were mm-hmm. teenagers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now that they've grown up and have families of their own, that they can bring their kids to see them back on the big screen. And again, we're not talking about necessarily cinematic masterpieces. We're not talking about Coppola or maybe we are talking about Spielberg, of course, but the influential movies of the 70s and 80s.
In some respects, too, you could lean a little bit on cult followings there, couldn't you?
Yes. The thing about the cult followings is if you start looking at the movies of that generation of the 70s and 80s, when people think of cult movies, they're really talking about the movies of the 70s. I mean, can you mm-hmm. think of a single title other than Reefer Madness? And some of the films of Ed Wood from the 40s and 50s. I mean, when you say the word cult classic, what comes to mind? Audrey?
Rocky Horror.
Exactly, which is
totally
what?
Abstract.
A genre movie. Claudio, if I say cult classic, what pops in your head?
Well, very much what you're talking about, 2001 Space Odyssey, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go Manson.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite cult classics is actually Once Upon a Time in the West, the Western.
Sergio Leone.
Yes. Exactly. I love that. Yes. I don't really care much for any of the others, but that one is like watching a great opera.
Right. Well, what we decided to do at the Carolina Theater was, again, to brand our identity. Of course, we would always be showing the most recent art house films that are out mm-hmm. there. You know, so we are always for all these years, we've always been showing the Slumdog Millionaires, the latest Coen Brothers film, Sense and Sensibility, and all right. the films, the big popular films that were playing at the other art house theaters in the area. But in addition to that, what we wanted to do was to set up a program where we could bring back cult classics, genre films, back on the big screen and try to build an audience. And of course, any time that you do this type of programming, the fear is always that the audience may not be there. You don't know.
Indeed. Right.
And right. these are not inexpensive little ventures that you get yourself into. I mean, you have to first track down the prints. You have to find, does the movie still exist on 35mm?
Sure, especially in this day and time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And start putting these programs together. And the very first program that we put together was called Retro Phantasma.
Ah.
Retro Phantasma.
Yes.
Retro Phantasma was started in 1998. And the idea was going to be that it would be a sporadic, it wasn't even a monthly feature back then. It was just every now and then, whenever we could find time to put a film up on the screen. But the idea was to try to find some of these genre films from the 70s and 80s, try to capitalize on all the universities in the Triangle to see if we could get some of the students to come to the Carolina Theater. Because remember back in the mid-90s, you know, the theater still doesn't have that branding yet.
And I was going to go get a little more scientific with the branding. What exactly do you mean?
Well, what I mean by branding is what I said before earlier, that there's the stereotype of what is an art house theater, mm-hmm. which is you walk in, you see the picture of Marilyn Monroe and James Dean and the big famous movie stars from the 40s and 50s. And what I wanted to do with the Carolina Theater's film program was you would have that image in your head of the James Dean and the Marilyn Monroe posters hanging right. in the lobby. But in addition to that, hanging next to them would be a Brian De Palma.
Okay.
a Brian De Palma film.
Or
an
Rocky
image
Horror,
from
whatever.
Or Carrie starring Sissy Spacek, yes. you know, or something like The Goonies from 1985, Mad Max.
Right.
I don't really understand, and it still sometimes bothers me sometimes of there is this concept out there that if it is not, people have this preconception that art house film is this little box, and in this box are a limited number of directors and a limited number of films. And in this box, you're not allowed to go outside that little box because if you are, you're no longer talking about art house film. You're now talking about basically commercial films.
Avant-garde commercial.
Well, I mean, and so
not for, even the
and
avant-garde.
So for, and so for me, the idea was why do we have to do the programming confined to what's in this box? The Hitchcocks, the Truffauts, the Godards, the Chaplins and things like that. I mean, not that those are not wonderful, brilliant films. They are. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to expand beyond that. And because to me, a good film is not necessarily a movie that is directed by one of these famous filmmakers. It can be a film that you just have a vivid memory of. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, growing up as a child of the 80s, for me personally, things like, you know, Mad Max, The Goonies, everything from Star Wars and Jaws all the way up through, you know, the Back to the Future trilogy, those are all movies that defined me growing up. So mm-hmm. what I wanted to do when we brought in the, you know, it was Retro Phantasma, is bring in some of these films. Now, we always knew that we were going to be doing the Hitchcocks and all the other, you know, classic titles. But I really do think that we were one of the first theaters in the Triangle that you could walk into the theater. Not only would we be showing the latest art house film, mm-hmm. but you'd also turn around and you would sometimes do a double take because you'd look in the lobby at the cinema lobby and you'd see a poster for something like Back to the Future or mm-hmm. some cheesy horror film from the 80s that you would say, you'd think to yourself, why is that playing or why is that poster hanging in the lobby of an art house theater? That is so much not what people imagine they're going to see when they walk into an art house theater. And the audience response has been wonderful, just wonderful. I have a lot of people that walk into the lobby because we do these movie displays in the lobby at the Carolina Theater mm-hmm. where we put up old movie posters. And I mean, if you were to walk into our lobby right now, I think you would see everything from David Cronenberg's The Fly mm-hmm. to little known titles like King of the Mountain, all the way across the board to Yentl with Barbara Streisand. Right. I mean, again, these are not films that people would look at and think to themselves, art house product. But again, you walk in it, you see these original one sheets hanging on the wall, and it brings back a wave of nostalgia.
And there's also the temptation of seeing this on big screen again instead of watching it on television.
Absolutely. But again, the nostalgia is the key. It's the idea that sometimes just seeing an image, a one sheet from a particular movie that you saw as a child or you saw back in the, you know, when you were younger, it will trigger an association of good memories. And that's really what it's all about. It's not just walking into the theater and seeing a great film. I want the audience to walk into the cinema lobby and suddenly just have a wave of nostalgia overflood them when they see a lot of the original lobby cards, the original standees, the one sheets, things like that.
And in many respects, the Carolina Theater itself is that to so many people, including you and me.
It is. It very much is.
Do you ever go back and show any of the silent films?
Well, we just finished a Charlie Chaplin retrospective.
Uh-huh, okay.
Just in the last month.
I'm thinking of Rudolph Valentino.
No, you know, the thing, here's, actually this will take us into a different area, but I think an area that we need to talk about, which is how hard it is sometimes to find 35mm prints.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Of some of these classic titles. There is this misconception out there, perhaps by some people, that it's, oh, they would love to have their own film festival. Film programming is so easy. There must be some catalog. If I open up the catalog in like a dictionary and I flip through the, you know, through the letter H and I find the title of the movie I'm looking for, and oh, look, there's the phone number of the person who owns the rights, and I call that number and they charge me X number of dollars and they ship me the movie and I show it on the big screen. Well, goodness, if it was that easy.
That's just Jim doing a drum roll there, by the way, folks.
Yes, if it was that easy, we'd all be out of a job. It's nothing like that. It is nothing like that.
How come we're out of a job anyway in this country?
Well, I mean, trying to sometimes even try to find 35mm prints. And we're not even talking about films that are necessarily old, even films that were released in the last 20 years. Trying to find 35mm prints of some titles is almost near to impossible.
So you're saying they've mostly been converted at this point to digital or other formats?
They've been converted. A lot of them have. But also, well, let's just take an example. Let's just find, I mean, name a film from the last 30 years that you're very fond of.
Blues Brothers.
The Blues Brothers.
There we go. That's
excellent.
A good one.
Audrey, that is an excellent title.
Absolutely.
All right. I mean,
Who invited you to this party?
I'm going to be a little bit of a film geek here and show my true colors by, it'll probably scare you, but Blues Brothers was a summer of 1980 release. It was released by Universal Pictures. It was one of the top 10 grossing films of the year. All right, it's directed by John Landis. Now, again, because this is the industry I work in, I can just pop most of that off the top of my head. Normal person wouldn't, I would suspect.
I know the title. Jim Belushi.
I enjoyed all the police cars getting smashed.
Yes, that was a great film.
But again, let's just take that title. So again, if average person looking up on the internet would track down the film, first of all, they'd have to figure out who is the rights holder. Who owns the rights to the Blues Brothers? Like I mentioned, it's Universal Pictures. But what you would probably need to do is get online, do an internet search, track it down, figure out, you know, who owns the rights. You find out it's Universal Pictures. The next step then would be to contact the rep at Universal Pictures and find out, do they still own the rights? Just because they released it 30 years ago doesn't mean that they still own the rights 30 years later. Many things could have happened in that interim. But coincidentally, Universal does still own the rights to the Blues Brothers. You talk to the rep. Now they'll say, we have the rights, but I can't guarantee that we have any prints. And that might startle you at first, you know, and you'll say to them, well, how is that possible? This is a top 10 grossing movie, one of the most famous comedy musicals in, you know, in history, a huge blockbuster. It probably opened on 1,000 screens 30 years ago, so there must have been at one point 1,000 different 35-millimeter prints of this film in existence. What happened? Well, the studio will look it through their archive, and they'll come back to you, and they might say, we have three prints in existence. Two of those three prints are in very, very poor condition. Now, most studios grade prints the way that we used to grade, you know, used to get our grades back in school on an A through F scale. And so they might come back to you and say, print number one is rated a C+, print number two is rated a B, and then print number three is a B-. They're going to try to get you the best print possible. And right. Sometimes they may just have to cobble a print by taking separate reels out of each of the different prints and forming an all-new print just to send you so that you can have something to watch and play on the big screen. But you'd be amazed at how many famous, we're not even talking obscure, but famous films, even within the last 20 years, have basically deteriorated in the vaults of major studios. So
even in the containers they were in, they're still
deteriorating. I mean, there's always the original element. You know, the original master print that's sitting in the vault refrigerated under lock and key that nobody has access to. They're not going to let that out of the studio vault, because if anything ever happened to that original element, the film would be lost. But we are talking about all the different prints that were made and struck from that original element. I mean, just to give you an example, Young Frankenstein. I just called 20th Century Fox.
Now a musical, by the way.
Yes. I just spoke with 20th Century Fox 2 weeks ago, trying to book a print of Young Frankenstein to show at the Carolina Theater. No prints exist.
What?
No prints in existence other than the master itself, which means that anytime if you want to see Young Frankenstein on a big screen, and we're not talking about locally, we're talking across the United States, you're going to see it as a digital reproduction.
I'll be darned.
Very, very. I mean, it's stunning, just quite stunning.
That's not so far back.
It's not so far back. And we're not even talking, you know, what's 1974. But especially as someone like myself, you know, who is a film programmer, who spends a lot of time doing research as to who owns the rights to particular titles, because we do so much repertory programming at the theater, I spend hours, and I mean hours each week, doing research, trying to figure out who owns the rights to a particular film, tracking that particular studio or producer down, and then trying to determine, does a 35-millimeter print still exist, and what condition is it in? Now, you would think that the studios would be very, very happy, especially with some of these big cash cow films that they have, like the Blues Brothers, to invest in striking a new 35-millimeter print, but that's not necessarily the case. The cost of striking a new 35-millimeter print, it's based on the length of the film, to be honest. The longer the film, the more film you're going to have to use to strike a print. But on average, it costs about $10,000 to strike a new 35-millimeter print off of the original negative. Now, you'd look at that compared to the budgets of these movies these days, you know, when they're spending $250 million for the latest Harry Potter film, what possibly is $10,000 to Warner Brothers to strike a new print of Young Frankenstein, or 20th Century Fox in this case? Well, you really can't look at it that way from the studio's point of view. When they rent out the title, they've invested $10,000 in striking a new print. They rent the title out to a studio or to a theater like myself, the Carolina Theater, they might charge me $300. How many times then does the film need to be rented before they're going to make back that $10,000? And more so than that, what is the likelihood that between them striking the film and them making back the $10,000 in rentals, that damage is not going to occur to that print or that a reel isn't going to fall off the back of some delivery truck, or that some very ambitious archivist out there isn't going to get their hands on that print and it's going to disappear.
So I'm sure there are some serious collectors that would be there.
Oh, yes. Some of those 35-millimeter prints are very, very, you know, very, very much. There is a black market out there for 35-millimeter print.
Let me interrupt for a moment just to remind anyone just tuning in. This is WCOM 103.5 FM, Claudio's Speakeasy and Radio Theater. I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Audrey. And also we have Jim Carl, the Senior Director of Carolina Theater, and we're talking about all kinds of stuff, but particularly... Actually, we've gone to film negatives at this point. We were talking retro phantasma and things that are happening at the Carolina Theater, and now we're going to continue on with Jim Carl and negatives and whatever direction we go in.
Yeah, I was saying before, the concept of this misconception that people have that this is my favorite movie, it must be so easy to find it, why don't you show this film up on the big screen? You're showing these films, why can't you show this? That's because in many cases, the film that they would like to see up on the big screen, it's very likely that prints no longer exist, or that the rights have become so tangled over the years that just trying to untangle who owns the rights to a particular film is equivalent to trying to, you know, take this big ball of yarn and, you know, find out where does the head begin. I mean, again, going back to the titles, even just 30 years ago, the studios go bankrupt. If you remember back in the early 80s, there were studios like the Ladd Company or Ryan Pictures.
Oh, yes.
These studios have gone bankrupt. Well, so what happens to their titles? Something like the Ladd Company in the 1970s, 1980s, AFCO Embassy Pictures from the 70s and 80s. You recognize these titles if you grew up in that time period, especially you remember the logos at the beginning of the VHSs.
Oh, yeah.
But so you take a look at something like Orion Pictures, Filmways International, AFCO Embassy. So many studios went bankrupt in the mid-80s and in the early 90s. Golem Globus, New World Pictures, Roger Corman Productions. So you have these famous, famous titles. And now here we are in 2010. You're trying to figure out who owns the rights to Outland, starring Sean Connery.
Yeah.
From 1981. Now, this was not a small independent film that just a few people saw. This was probably a film that opened at 800 theaters, which means there must have been 800 prints at one point. A major star, a massive campaign, marketing campaign.
Something in the vein of a Space Odyssey, yeah.
Yeah. So now here we are, 29 years later, sitting in 2010, trying to find a print of Outland. Where do you start? Well, number one, the production company or the distributor of the film, the Ladd Company, is bankrupt. There's no one to call.
Hmm.
Where did those 800 prints go?
So you're a regular gumshoe for the cinema here.
Sounds like the history detectives or something.
It does. Sometimes it is quite fun because sometimes it is a matter of unraveling this long trail just to find out. And sometimes you come up with nothing. You go through all of this research to try to figure out who owns the rights to the film. You finally track down the producer. And in many cases, what's happened is that the studio went bankrupt. Another rival studio came along and in many cases purchased the library. The library is all the films that bankrupt studio once owned. But that's not always the case. In many cases, a rival studio will come along, take a look at this bankrupt studio's catalog and their library, and cherry pick only the certain titles that they want.
Not surprised.
Then they'll walk away and they'll own the. So now you've got to figure out, and it really is. You're
the
trying to figure out.
The library gets scattered all
it
over.
It gets scattered all over. And in many cases, the rights to that library of the bankrupt studio, the rights revert back to the producers of the original film.
Ah, my goodness.
Well, then how are you going to find them?
A lot of them are gone.
A lot of them are gone. So that means that now it's the estate holders. And of course, now we're talking about individuals like you and I. You know, we don't have the capability to, if somebody were to suddenly call us up and say that, you know, my great uncle coincidentally was this famous filmmaker back in the 1970s and that he has left me in his will 300 prints of 35 millimeter prints. What am I supposed to do with these titles? You know, they've already been cherry picked. So they're obviously not the huge films. I don't have the refrigeration capability to keep these prints in mint condition. They're probably not in good condition. Most people who inherit 35 millimeter prints that are passed down throw them in the garbage. Mm. They throw them in the garbage. Huh. They put them on sale on eBay. They try to get rid of them.
Stick them in a box in the attic.
They stick them in a box in the attic. Right. That's what happens. Uh-huh. And, you know, 20, 30 years pass, and someone like myself or another film programmer comes along that's trying to find the rights to a particular title are just having a hell of a time trying to figure out where does this go. And people will say to me, well, why don't you just go to IMDb, the International Movie Database, on the Internet? Well, that's unreliable. The IMDb on the Internet will only tell you who was the original rights holder back at the time of the film's release. It does not tell you who is the current right holder, perhaps 20 or 30 years later. And so I know that was a very, very long way to go to get back to your question, Audrey, about silent films and Rudolph Valentino. No,
is this still the same day?
But in answer to your question, you can see why the further back you go trying to track down even the older films becomes almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Now, thankfully, there are a few distributors out there, not many, but there are a few that specialize in the classics. There's Janus Films, there's Rialto Pictures. These are small, independently owned studios that do nothing but keep track of some of the major classics from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and bless them for that, for at least having a few out there. I mean, there are the archives at the University of California at Los Angeles. There is the National Film Registry. I mean, there's a couple of sources that you can go to try to track down the rights, if the film is well known enough. But again,
I can imagine
if you're talking about something fun like Looker from 1981, which was directed by Michael Crichton. Again, another LAD company release. Somebody like UCLA is not going to be able to help you.
Let's spill a little bit into Retro Phantasma that you've got that you're putting together right now at the Carolina Theater.
Sure. Well, like I said,
when does that actually start?
Well, our new season actually starts this coming Friday.
Aha.
Now, Retro Phantasma, Retro Phantasma has been going on for 12 years now. It's our monthly genre.
Happy birthday, Retro.
It's our monthly genre film series. And again, this is one of those programs that we started early on. The idea was to give the theater an identity, a branding. And like I said before,
keep seeing this image of a couch, a branding.
But the idea was to bring back films back on the big screen in original 35 millimeter and from the 70s, 80s, 60s, you know, things like that, that were genre films. Mm-hmm. And we've shown everything from all of the major classics like The Exorcist, House on Haunted Hill, the way to, you know, I have this thing called the 20-year rule. Every Retro Phantasma screening, we have these little surveys where people can write in what is the number one film that you'd like to see at an upcoming, you know, presentation. Mm-hmm. And I try to qualify that. Otherwise, I do start getting a lot of requests for films that were just in theaters last year. You know, so I have a 20-year rule where I say if the film is not at least a minimum of 20 years old, with some exceptions, not too many, but with some, it's probably not going to be old enough to bring back to the big screen to justify the cost. Most people, I would say you'd have to have at least two generations removed for a film to really start to qualify, to make you want to see it back on the big screen. I mean, there's really no reason to bring back something like Titanic, show it back on the big screen right now, because so many of us own it on DVD or on Blu-ray and things like that.
You're talking about the current version. Of course, there's the original one that goes back to the 30s, actually,
yes,
I think.
Yes, but again, so I do try to qualify. I do let people know up front that, you know, don't be putting Saw 3D or The Final Destination or Urban Legend on these forms. You're just wasting your time.
So what are we kicking it off with this year?
Well, this year we found a rare archive print of a 1981 horror film starring Melissa Sue Anderson from Little House on the Prairie, but directed by J. Lee Thompson, who was the nominated director of The Guns of Navarone, called Happy Birthday to Me.
Oh, right.
Which I just thought was the perfect, if you're going to run a horror film, on your 12th anniversary, on your own birthday, why not have a film called Happy Birthday to Me?
That's got to be a poster for collectors. I remember that picture.
It is. It's a very infamous one sheet. And one of the things that, again, with this particular retrospective, Retro Phantasma, that's happened over the last decade is that we've built up a reputation, not just with the local audiences, but also with the distributors and the studios, to the point where they've been very, very generous to us to allow us to take out of their vaults particular films that most other theaters in the country are not allowed to touch. And that says a lot. We've got some of the best projection staff, I believe, in the Triangle working at the Carolina Theater who really understand how to handle original 35mm prints. Because remember, if a studio is going to allow you to take an original print out of their vault, which may be the last surviving 35mm print in existence, and you scratch it up.
That's certainly trust.
Yeah, and you scratch it up. I mean, the cost of trying to fix that again is going to be about $10,000 or $15,000. So they're very particular, especially with their vault prints. And it's taken a while. I will admit it has taken a while. Universal Pictures was the first to come on board a couple of years ago to allow us to the permission to take out some of their vault prints. And now Columbia, Sony, has started to allow us to do that as well. And now Warner Brothers. So we're getting a reputation with some of the major studios that we are a venue that will take care of original prints.
I would imagine the fact that it's a historic house plays into that a little bit as well.
Perhaps. I mean, but when you take a look at the other theaters that are allowed to take out some of these prints, we're talking about, you know, things like the New Beverly in Los Angeles, the Kennedy Center, Film Forum in New York. So it does say something that we are finally allowed to take out some of these prints. But anyway, going back to Retro Phantasma, what Retro Phantasma is and what it's always been designed to be is just a night of fun. It's a double feature. So you'll have an A title and a B title, two films back to back.
Come to the bucket of blood. We'll make you happy.
But the idea was also, you know, we show the classic trailers in front of each of the films. And we've designed the trailer.
You don't show Movie Tone News, do you?
I wish we could.
that would be awesome, yeah.
But what we do is we design a trailer package in front of each of the films that's designed. There's a running scroll with music that appears on the screen prior to each film, letting you have some interesting facts about the film. So, for example, this Friday we're showing Happy Birthday to Me. Mm-hmm. If you were to be at the audience that Friday night, what you would see is a scroll welcoming you to the theater, welcoming you to the Retro Phantasma film series, and then it would say something like, today's date is May 13th, 1981. It is the opening night
That's good.
Happy Birthday to Me at theaters across the country. Yeah. Then we go into these facts as if it were 1981. Everything about the production of the film leading up to the release that night in 1981. And then it closes with the title card that will say, the following motion pictures are coming soon to a theater near you in 1981. And I spend tremendous...
All of this precedes the movie.
All of this precedes the movie. And I do spend a tremendous amount of time on researching on the internet so that the trailer package of the four or five trailers that you sit down and watch prior to that film's screening would have been indeed something that you would have seen if you had been sitting in a theater in 1981 at the premiere of Happy Birthday to Me that night.
So it's time travel. It's a whole time travel package.
But again, it's a lot of fun. I mean, again, this is something that we can do that I am not aware of any other theater that does this type of programming, where, again, not only are you showing classic trailers, but you're showing a trailer package that's specifically created to take you back in time to the night that the film originally premiered and what would have been playing. So then you see the movie and then you see the B title, and
I can see a group of people getting together and saying, you know, I want to go in costume.
Oh, I'm sure that happens.
Yes, 1980 dress, and we'll do a whole, you know, a whole 1980s night.
Or come in,
be perfect.
Come in with the punk scene, wasn't that? Was kind of what was taken off back in those days. Yeah,
yeah. But over the years, I mean, like I said, we're about to have our 12th birthday, but launch our 13th season, if that makes sense. So this coming Friday will be 12 years ago today well, 12 years ago that the Retro Phantasma was born, but we are launching our 13th season. And so because of that length of time, we've now become one of the longest running monthly genre film series in the United States.
Fantastic. I imagine that that's got to help in some way.
It does. It gives us an identity, but it also gives the theater an identity. You know, it gives us that, again, that word that you love so much, the branding.
Oh, yes. you know, well, I think, too, that we have the other aspect of the theater as well, the live performances. Mm-hmm. I think in many respects, the Carolina Theater has become sort of another house of blues. It seems like every artist with any kind of a name out there that is truly respected for his craft wants the Carolina Theater on the portfolio.
It is true.
I really think so.
I mean, and just out of sheer fun, I mean, one of the events, not necessarily a blues artist, but going back to the film, we have John Waters' Christmas coming up in December. John Waters, filmmaker from the 60s and 70s, very avant-garde, independent, you know, struck out and started making more commercial films in the 80s with things like Hairspray and Serial Mom, but now is considered this master, mastermind. He is a mastermind. But yeah, John Waters is coming to the theater, but I mean, again, based off of the audience that we've already built with things like Retro Phantasma, when something like a John Waters is announced, there's a huge crossover. Very much of a huge crossover, because so many of the audience has been educated through Retro Phantasma and our sister program, Retro Phantasma Classics, to who some of these directors are, some of these genre, again, back to that word, genre directors. But we're really, really proud about this year's lineup.
You want to drop some names of the lineup?
Sure. We're not officially announcing it till this weekend. So,
Am I jumping the gun here?
This is a scoop.
You're hearing it first and only on Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here on WCOM 103.5 FM. Did I get it in?
Boom. You got it in.
Well, this is going to be a test on my fading memory, because I have to do this all off the top of my head. Now, don't forget, we have a sister program called Retro Phantasma Classics. Mm-hmm. If the original intention would be that Retro Phantasma is genre films from the 70s and 80s, and possibly now the early 90s, you know, that 20-year rule coming into effect.
And just a reminder, keep in mind, we have about 4 or 5 minutes to wrap this up.
Then Retro Phantasma Classics is our sister program with genre films from the 40s, 50s, and 60s and early 70s. So what have we got coming up? Well, December we'll have... Retro Phantasma Classics will be a Vincent Price double feature.
All right.
Like Mask of the Red Death and Theater of Blood.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Retro Phantasma will be what I consider to be, again, the idea of the psychological thriller, Brian De Palma's Dress to Kill, and Lauren Bacall starring in a film called The Fan from 1981.
I remember that, too.
Yeah. In January will be a Jamie Lee Curtis double feature. Jamie Lee Curtis was one of the original Scream Queens back in the early 80s.
Are we talking Halloween?
She was in Halloween, but we're not showing Halloween. We're going to be showing a film called Terror Train from 1980, a Canadian slasher flick. And the B title is going to be John Carpenter's The Fog, starring his then wife, Adrienne Barbeau. And then in Retro Classics, and we are going to be showing Howard Hawks' original The Thing from Outer Space with a double feature from, I'm sorry, The Thing from Another World, along with the double feature of Forbidden Planet. But we've got some great titles.
We've got some great titles.
Everything from Roman Polanski's The Fearless Vampire Killers.
One of my absolute favorite movies.
Talk about a real hard time finding a print.
I bet.
The original.
I had a hard time finding the DVD.
Well, the original Village of the Damned, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, The Witchfinder General. I mean, just lots of great titles for Retro Phantasma Classics. And then for regular retro, great titles that are also classics. Things like the original Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
Australia's answer to Carrie, called Patrick. Pet Sematary, The Changeling with George C. Scott.
I remember that one too.
Eyes of Laura Mars with Faye Dunaway.
Yep.
You know, Visiting Hours with Lee Grant. So Retro Phantasma and Retro Phantasma Classics. Again, the lineup gets officially announced this coming Friday at the Carolina Theater during our 12th anniversary birthday bash, and we'll have all the big programs, and we're going to have a huge cake. the original trailer for Happy Birthday to Me, if anybody ever wants to YouTube
it. Who gets the spike in the cake?
Well, that's what's funny. And I have to do this. I know we're about to wrap up.
Absolutely.
But the original concept of, if you've seen the poster for Happy Birthday to Me, it's very, very infamous, with a man's head with about to be shish kebabbed.
It's a brochette, I should have said. Brochette.
Yes. And it was a very famous one sheet. And so the original trailer, of course, was just a round cake with this gloved figure lighting candles. And the word Happy Birthday to Me is written on the candle as the voiceover is intoning about the deaths and blah, blah, blah. And at the last second, the big axe comes crashing down into the cake. And then it fades out to the title Happy Birthday to Me. So we thought it would be fun. For our 12th anniversary bash, that not only were you going to recreate the cake, of course, I couldn't find an axe, but, you know, I did find this really cool knife.
Oh, yes,
here.
You did.
He's waving a knife in the studio, folks.
He's got a weapon.
We'll be plunging the knife into the cake, but not only that, we're going to do shish kebabs. Rather than serving the cake and cutting it up, we're actually going to have long shish kebabs with cake on the shish kebab and passing it out to the audience. So
that's
come
perfect.
Have shish kebab cake. Yes. We stay, you know, we're around for 12 years, and then we start arming people. That is us at the Retro Phantasma Film Series.
Well, thank you so much for disarming us.
Very much a pleasure to sit with both of you. I feel like I'm monopolizing it all the time.
No. I like it. I like it when I don't have to answer the question. He both suggested the question and went right into the answer, so there was really no need for me to be here today.
I try to include you every now and then.
Thank you so much.
It's your own show. I think you should have something to say in it.
We let him talk once in a while.
Yes, I appreciate those notions. So, time for us to bring this to a wrap. You are one bolt of energy, and I can understand why. You gave me some of this full-throttle energy drink and then wouldn't let me speak. It's no wonder you were flying down the road so fast, but it was absolutely educational to hear this.
Like I said, there's a lot to cover there, and I hope I didn't confuse some of the viewers by some of the things I said. And again, very, very, very thank you both so much for inviting me to be on the show.
Absolute pleasure to have you on.
Your pleasure.
You're part of the Speakeasy family, so this won't be the last time. We'll get you again.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank everybody out there for tuning us in. This is WCOM 103.5 FM, Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, with Audrey Layden in the studio, Jim Carl, the senior director of the Carolina Theater, and yours truly, Claudio, of this place, Easy Speak. Until next time, cheers.